The scriptures of the Restoration have a way of pushing us beyond prevailing scholarly paradigms, sometimes even requiring us to return to the primary sources and rebuild from the ground up. This is a healthy process, part of learning by study and also by faith. The present study began with a passage from the Doctrine and Covenants, section 124. In verses 29 to 33, the Lord states that the ordinance of baptism for the dead belongeth to my house. He goes on to say that there is a sufficient time appointed, after which the baptisms would no longer be acceptable. For the saints in our dispensation, this sufficient time was only 6 years after the church was officially organized. The mention of this localization of the ordinance being instituted from before the foundation of the world in verse 33 implies that it was true in prior dispensations as well. Yet our doctrine also maintains that baptism for the dead began to be practiced in the dispensation of the meridian of time, after Jesus organized the preaching of the gospel to the spirits in prison. Thus Paul gives us the first and only biblical reference to this ordinance. Else what shall they do which are baptized for the dead, if the dead rise not at all? Why are they then baptized for the dead? 1 Corinthians 15:29. Where then did early Christians perform their baptisms for the dead? Just as the Latter-day Saints in Nauvoo were commanded to build a temple in which to perform this ordinance, did early Christians build temples with baptismal fonts? Most scholars who have studied the development of sacred space in early Christianity have maintained that early Christians did not build temples. The specifics of this development are subject to different theories, but most agree that the church replaced the Jewish temple only rhetorically and not with a new physical temple. Nibley makes a sharp distinction between the primitive church, which continued the tradition of temple rites, and the later church, which was, by all accounts, a totally different thing, which tried to continue the temple rites but failed, attempting for a time to establish its own substitutes for the temple. According to Nibley, the primitive church was centered on the temple in Jerusalem, and when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, it was a devastating blow from which the church never recovered. The church continued to preserve the rites in secret, but these were eventually corrupted and diffused. The later church was dependent on the Jewish synagogue for its rites, which accords with the contemporary theory, contemporary with Nibley, that is, that early Christian churches were based architecturally on the synagogue. The endpoint of Nibley's paradigm is the reforms of Constantine in the 4th century, when the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem was revived as the replacement of the ancient temple. More recently, L. Michael White, on the basis of a careful survey of archaeological and textual evidence, proposes a four-stage development of Christian religious buildings, from meeting in members' homes to the adoption of the basilica under Constantine. In this development, the buildings became progressively larger and took on more and more monumental characteristics, all driven by the need of Christian communities for larger places of assembly. The temple, however, has no place in this model. Can the current scholarly models be reconciled with the practice of baptism for the dead? One might assume that early Christians, like the Latter-day Saints in Nauvoo, resorted to natural bodies of water to perform their proxy baptisms, an option that the Lord permits according to Doctrine and Covenants 124, though only for an appointed time that is sufficient to build a house unto me. It is also possible that those to whom Paul refers in 1 Corinthians 15:29 were practicing a corrupt form of Christianity, as many biblical commentators assume. Though the fact that the prophet quotes this passage approvingly in Doctrine and Covenants 128:16 makes this interpretation less viable for Latter-day Saints. My own investigation, however, suggests the need for a more nuanced paradigm. I will argue on the basis of two sites in the Near East that some early Christians did in fact have places of worship that are best classified as temples. I would emphasize at the outset that the data I am discussing are not new. Indeed, White discusses both of these sites, and one of them features prominently in his model. What is new here is my approach to the data, which is prompted by Doctrine and Covenants 124. This brings up questions that do not feature in previous studies, which lead in turn to some new findings. I will conclude with some reflections on the lessons learned in this study and how they might inform future Latter-day Saint studies of ancient temples. Ancient Edessa, the modern city of Urfa on the Dison River in modern southeastern Turkey, is thought by some scholars to be the site of the biblical Ur of the Chaldees, the birthplace of Abraham. In the early centuries of the Common Era, Edessa became the center of Christian worship and the starting place for the spread of Syriac Christianity throughout the Middle East. Among the vast corpus of Syriac historical writings is a brief chronicle of Edessa, composed in the 6th century but based on older records found in the archives of Edessa, which are mentioned within the text itself. These same archives are independently mentioned by Eusebius and are extolled for their reliability by several other ancient sources. This chronicle preserves for us the earliest surviving reference to a building devoted to Christian worship. The context of this reference is an account of a flood which occurred in 201 CE or AD, which destroyed the city's palace and several other buildings. The text reads, "And in that same hour, the waters broke through the western wall of the city and entered inside the city. They broke down the great and beautiful palace of our Lord the King, and they carried away everything that was found before them, the pleasant and beautiful buildings of the city, everything that was near the river to the south and north of it. And they also damaged the temple of the Church of the Christians, the temple of the Church of the Christians, and more than 2,000 people were killed by this occurrence." Here note that the Christian building, the very first attested in any ancient source, is specifically referred to as a temple, Syriac Hykla. While this fact has been known for some time, it is generally dismissed by scholars. After all, later Christian writers commonly referred to Christian churches as temples, in line with Christian rhetoric setting up the church as the successor of the temple in Jerusalem. Yet a close reading of the Chronicle of Edessa suggests that the term as used here is not merely figurative, nor is it connected to the later Christian usage. The Chronicle contains many further references to churches. These further references conform to a distinct pattern of terminology, yet the flooded temple of 201 seems to belong to a separate category. The references to religious buildings in the Chronicle are tabulated here. The terms used for the religious buildings in this text sort into 6 types. Hykla the, followed by the name of a religious group, meaning the temple of a given religion. This type is found only in the first century, dated 201. Aita the, followed by the name of a city, meaning the main church building of a city. Baith, house, followed by the name of a saint. Baith Ma'mudita the, followed by the name of a city, meaning the main baptistry of a city. Baith Sahde le, followed by the name of a saint, meaning the martyrion of a saint. And Hykla the, literally temple of, followed by the name of a saint, meaning a church building dedicated to a saint. There seems to be a fundamental shift in usage between the first entry, dated 201 AD, and the subsequent entries mentioning buildings, which start in the time of Constantine over a century later. Not once in the later entries is it necessary to qualify the term Hykla by the name of a specific religion. The 201 entry is from a period in which there were many temples of various religions in Edessa, making it necessary to specify which religion the temple belongs to. We know from other evidence that there were indeed many temples in the region. If this were a mere domestic dwelling, as White's paradigm would assume, it is doubtful that the term for temple would have been used, or that it would have been mentioned in the chronicle at all. Later, from 313 to 503 AD, we see the shift in usage. A group of terms, including Aita, Baita, and Hykla, seem to be synonymous to refer to typical Byzantine-style churches. Therefore, we have at least one solid reference to a specifically Christian building, known to the record keeper as a temple, in Edessa in 201. On the assumption that the building was constructed somewhat earlier, we can tentatively place it in the latter half of the second century. The textual evidence from Edessa can be further illuminated by bringing it into comparison with archaeological evidence from another city, Dura Europos, which was situated on the Euphrates River about 200 miles southeast of Edessa. The two cities, like many in the Syrian cultural area in late antiquity, are broadly comparable in terms of their religious demographics. Both cities had several large pagan temples, a single more modest Christian establishment, and a single Jewish synagogue. The two cities were also linguistically similar, with Greek and Syriac being used. The Christian building at Dura Europos began as a domestic house, perhaps used for gatherings by a growing Christian community. This house underwent renovations to convert it into a place of worship in 232 AD. On the south side of the building, a wall was torn down to form an elongated assembly room. The bench that originally lined the walls was also eliminated and replaced by a single dais at the east end of the room. The plaster floor of the open courtyard in the center of the house was covered with tiles. In the room at the northwest corner of the building, called by the excavators Room 6, a beautiful arched baptismal font was installed, and the walls were painted with religious scenes. Kraling states that the changes in Room 6 were more extensive than in any other part of the premises, the new installations more monumental, and the decor applied to the walls sumptuous by local standards. Among the several rooms of the house, this one became the most elegant and, as a room devoted to ceremonial use, in all probability the most sacred. That's again quoting from Kraling. Finally, an upper room, something that was not common at Dura, according to Kraling, was added directly above the baptistry of Room 6. This building is one of the main examples White adduces in his category of the Domus Ecclesiae, which refers to a domestic space that has been adapted to make it more suitable for the specialized religious and social functions of Christian assembly. However, the term Domus Ecclesiae, along with the typological characterization that this term carries with it, namely the characterization as a stage in the development of the Basilica Church, are scholarly constructs developed by White himself. This term is not attested at Dura Europos. Thus, the way in which this building was characterized by the Christian community at Dura remains an open question. Does the notion of a temple, defined here in Latter-day Saint terms, as a sacred place for priesthood ordinances, including redemptive work for the dead, fit with the Christian building at Dura Europos? There are four reasons why I would answer affirmatively. First, the care and decoration given to the baptistry, in proportion to the rest of the building, recalls the importance of baptism for the dead in Doctrine and Covenants 124. There is no way to know whether the font in Room 6 was used for the living only, for the living on behalf of the dead, or both. However, the features of the font and the themes of the surrounding decorations are compatible with the possibility that baptisms for the dead were performed there. The font, large enough for total immersion, is also deep enough that its floor is below that of the surrounding rooms. This answers to the principle that the font, as a similitude of the grave, was commanded to be in a place underneath where the living are wont to assemble. Doctrine and Covenants 128, 12 through 13. The most prominent of the wall paintings, immediately visible to anyone entering the room, is the procession of women on the north and east walls. Although this painting has been interpreted in different ways, many suggest that it represents the women approaching Christ's tomb on the morning of the resurrection. However, there are no clear indications of Christ or of the Easter narrative in the composition, so it can also be understood as a generic funeral procession. The women approach toward the font, ending at a peaked structure, thought to represent a tomb, immediately to the right of the font. This would certainly suggest a connection between baptism and the dead who are to emerge from the grave. Underneath the arch, immediately behind the font, is a representation of Adam and Eve flanking the tree of knowledge of good and evil, a reminder of how death entered the world, along with a representation of Christ as the Good Shepherd. Other paintings in the room show Christ lifting Peter from the depths to walk on the water, and Christ healing the paralytic. In both cases, Christ stretches out his hand, and in the scene of walking on the water, this culminates in a grip with Peter's hand. Both of these scenes are suggestive of Christ's power to redeem and to raise the dead. Second, the existence of an upper room directly above the baptistry allows for the possibility of an ascending sequence of ordinances from baptism to other rites and covenants. The stairs leading up to the upper room are just east of the baptistry. Third, the building is broadly similar in both size and manner of development to the pagan temples and the Jewish synagogue at Dura. Kraling remarks that the size of the Christian building was comparable to that of the earlier phase of the Jewish synagogue. Further, White shows that many of the pagan temples at Dura developed, as the Christian building did, from domestic buildings into monumental sacred structures through a series of renovations and expansions. The Jewish synagogue at Dura also developed in the same way. This runs counter to the assumption that converting a house into a place of worship was a specifically Christian practice, which partially lies behind the choice of the term Domus Ecclesiae. Conversely, it shows that the development of the building at Dura fits with the cross-religious pattern of temple building in that region. Fourth, some scholars connect the features of the assembly hall and the Dura building with a contemporary textual source describing the order of the Eucharist, known as Didaskalia Apostolorum. This text, originally composed in Greek somewhere in Syria around 230 AD, survives in Greek only in a single fragment, but is fully preserved in Syriac. The text gives instructions for the positions and behavior of the bishop, elders, deacons, and members during the Eucharist, recalling the order of the priesthood for the temple in Kirtland as described in Doctrine and Covenants 88, 119 to 141. It also mentions a throne for the bishop, which is likely what the dais at the east end of the assembly hall at Dura is. But most important for our purposes is the following exhortation to bishops at the beginning of the text. Wala teshron by teh de maria, wala tevdurun amme. Do not profane the house of the Lord, nor scatter his people. The term used here, Baiteh de Maria, is exactly like the common term used for the temple in the Hebrew Bible, Beit Adonai, the house of the Lord. As the text continues, the place of assembly is consistently referred to as Baita, the house, a shortened form of Baiteh de Maria. The combined evidence of the archaeology of the Christian building at Dura Europos, the Chronicle of Edessa, and the Didaskalia Apostolorum is strongly suggestive of how the building at Dura Europos was conceptualized among those who actually used it. It is unfortunate that White should choose a Latin term, Domus Ecclesiae, to describe a building that was likely never described in its own time in Latin, and that was likely never conceptualized as a house of the church. To be sure, the word eita, church, which occurs in the post-Constantinian entries of the Chronicle of Edessa in reference to church buildings, occurs in the Didaskalia Apostolorum. But in the Didaskalia Apostolorum, the term never refers to an actual building, having instead its original sense of church assembly or congregation, and it never occurs in combination with the word for house. Instead, based on the Didaskalia Apostolorum and the Chronicle of Edessa, we have two terms for a Christian building in the Syrian milieu during this period. The term used in a Christian context would be Baiteh de Maria, house of the Lord. And the term used in a more general context would be Haikla de Ita da Christiane, temple of the Church of the Christians. Scholarship so far has taken developments in the western parts of the Roman Empire as an interpretive frame for developments across Christendom. According to current paradigms, we shouldn't have anything that should be called a temple as early as 201. And having such a fine baptismal font inside a building when the Euphrates River was just down the hill is unexpected. But the evidence from the region of Syria, interpreted in its own context, offers us a picture of early Christianity that actually fits comfortably with Doctrine and Covenants 124. It seems to me more than coincidence that of the two earliest known buildings devoted to Christian worship, one was specifically called the temple, and the other had a baptismal font as its most prominent feature. This study also raises some larger questions that might impact Latter-day Saint studies of ancient temples. For instance, how do we know a temple when we see one? And of the myriad temples we can identify in ancient records and excavations, which qualify from a Latter-day Saint standpoint as true temples akin to our own, that is, sacred places whose ordinances focus on bringing people to the Messiah, binding people to God through covenants, and uniting families for eternity. Several studies in the past have attempted to answer questions like these using a typological approach, like John Lundquist's Typology of Temples, published in the volume Temples of the Ancient World. But this study shows that it is very difficult to know how a given ritual space was conceptualized by the people who used it, unless we have written texts to help fill out the picture. The archaeological evidence uncovered at Dura Europos definitely allows us to identify Christian ritual space there. It even allows us to determine that baptisms were performed there, but it doesn't tell us how early Christians characterized that space. For this, the Christian the Syriac textual evidence, the Chronicle of Edessa and Didascalia Apostolorum, is crucial. With these observations in mind, I would suggest that we need to develop a new approach in our studies of ancient temples. The two legs of this approach would be, first, a typological approach to archaeological evidence, paying particular attention to the relationship between ritual spaces and other types, such as domestic spaces. And second, a cultural historical approach to textual evidence in its original languages, paying particular attention to the variety of ways in which different textual genres may inform us about the ideology attached to ritual space. I hope to develop each of these points in future studies. With this new approach, we will be able to move beyond suggestive comparisons and achieve greater accuracy in identifying temple space, including temples that are most relevant to our heritage as Latter-day Saints.